since the audience is rather eclectic, I'm going to start off with just a little bit of background so that you can put the problem that I'm going to present to you in some context. Okay. Now, of course, for any physiological process, there's going to be a component that was contributed by the genotype, the genetics, and that's nature. And then there's going to be a component that modulates its expression that comes from the environment. And that, of course, we call nurture. We're only going to concentrate on this. We're not going to get into osteoporosis or anything like that. Now, the story of modern concept of how the environment modulates bone behavior begins in the 1800s. A guy by the name of Julius Wolf, who was an orthopedic surgeon, noticed that the distribution of the trabecular matrix in a slice of bone, if you cut bone longitudinally and you present the two halves, you see this pattern of the trabeculae, okay, which is bone that is in the form of struts. The struts are arranged like this, and it reminded him of a stress diagram for a Coleman crane that engineers had developed. And the Coleman crane is a German version of this Fairbairn crane, which is an English version of the same kind of crane. And this is operating in the 19th century, the typical kind of crane. What he deduced as a result of looking at enough of these kinds of pictures and talking with engineers was that the strains in bone tissue resulting from environmental stresses are the signals which direct the remodeling patterns. Now, what do we mean by remodeling? Bone is constantly undergoing a transformation, a replenishing. It undergoes resorption. Okay, the bone is resorbed by certain cells called osteoclasts, and it undergoes osteogenesis, built up by cells called osteoblasts. This is going on all the time. I see the majority of the audience seems to be in an age group where it's probably going on at the rate so that your bone is completely replaced in 7 years. Some of us old-timers, it's really long, really slows down. But it's going on all the time. It's remodeling. And there seems to be some directedness to this remodeling process as expressed in the trabecular pattern. And Wolf developed this idea for the relationship between the environment, the stresses, and the expressed pattern of the matrix. He called it a law. Now, all the physicists and engineers in here, the scientific engineers, will say, this is no law. It's just an expression of how the forces are acting on the material, which is bone, and that's it. You know, nothing really about the connection to the result. There's no analytical form here. Well, subsequent to this discovery, which was published in 1892, orthopedic surgeons and experimenters began to see the pattern of osteogenesis and resorption or remodeling in terms of Wolf's law. And when they connected the two of them together, to be more specific, talk about tension and compression rather than just environmental stresses, there developed what is known as the Heuter-Volkmann law. Under tension, the parts of bone that are under tension tend to express osteogenesis. The parts of bone that are under compression tend to express resorption. Okay, so you can shift this remodeling pattern, resorption, osteogenesis, in either direction, depending upon the kind of stress. And this ruled for a number of years. And I think we need to talk about where these stresses come from. There are two sources of the forces, or the forces that induce the stresses in bone. First, there's the muscle contraction. And that consists of any muscle that's inserted in a bone. And at the insertion point, of course, the muscle contracts, and the other insertion of the muscle is on another bone, separated by a joint. When that muscle contracts, it pulls on the bone, and this section of the bone is jammed up against the joint and undergoes compression. This part of this bone, we'll imagine it's the leg, just for purposes of argument, as it's lifted, the weight of gravity pulls down on it, so it undergoes tension. Now, of course, when this individual, if this is the leg, steps back down on the leg, there's a tremendous amount of compression throughout this cortical bone. And by the way, this is what we're going to keep referring to. We're really going to focus on cortical bone. Okay? Well, I'm glad that's so, all right. The other component, we're not going to talk a lot about gravity except for what I just said. We're going to focus more on what the muscles do in this dog. Now, Wolf did not explain how the stresses from the environment were translated into the structure of bone. He just said they were, and that's it. And then everybody was left to fend for themselves. It wasn't until the 1940s where some ideas began to come up into the minds of people looking into this field. And the ideas really came from an explosion of information about cell electrophysiology. It was revealed at this time that practically every cell that was looked at was electrically active. And they could exchange ions with the outside, they had charges on their surface, and they could conduct currents. Now, if you couple this with the observation that proteins, such as collagen, which is the protein that gets ossified, or that gets mineralized to give you the hard part of bone, these are Zwitterions. And of course, they're electrically active, and they could act as conductors. You put these two together, and you put it, add a little observation, a Japanese physicist by the name of Fukada showed that every protein that he distributed into a sheet, dried it out, put it in a sheet, put a couple of electrodes on it, and bent it, every protein that he subjected this procedure to showed a piezoelectric current. And they were acting like crystals in the old radios. Yasuda, who was an orthopedic surgeon, he took these ideas, put them together, and formulated a hypothesis that the bone collagen was piezoelectrically converted, was converted to a piezoelectric conductor by the bending stress. And currents resulted, which then activated the bone cells which were associated with this matrix made of collagen. And now we had something of a mechanism for Wolf's Law. But Yasuda used dry bone. Okay? And that was a little bit of an error. It led a lot of people to try a lot of electrical healing devices, which seemed to work. And some orthopedic surgeons made a lot of money off of this. They seemed to work, but they're still somewhat controversial. And I remain skeptical of them. Now, it's been known since 1970, okay, when something else happened, that the mechanical signal which modulates bone behavior in vivo comes directly from the fluid, more of the fluid of the bone than the dry part of the bone. And that's the result of a paper that was published by Anderson and Erickson. They decided to repeat the Yasuda experiment with wet bone. And when they compared the current contributed to by the dry part of the bone and the current contributed to by the wet part of the bone, they found that less than 3% of that current came from the dry part of the bone. Thus was born the fluid basis for the electrical activity of bone as it modulates bone cells. So a little review here. Here's Julius Wolf, 1884. He came up with the idea in 1884. It took him to 1892 to publish the tome. It's an enormous tome. Okay. And if you want to have fun, try to read it in German. Yasuda, in 1953, he actually discussed this with Fukada a lot. He worked on dry bone, and he came up with his hypothesis, and he used Fukada's idea. And then Anderson and Erickson, 1970, finally, after 13 years, they decided to try an experiment with wet bone. Now, a little bit later, 7 years later, Pekarsky and Monroe looked a little closer at the fluid in the bone. All that Anderson and Erickson found out was that you need the fluid in the bone to get the current. What Pekarsky and Monroe found out was that there was flow of this fluid. Not only was the flow that they observed modulating bone metabolism, but the flow always moved from the inside toward the outside of the bone. An important observation. It was as if the bone, cortical bone that we talked about before, had valves in it. The fluid would not go toward the center. It would always go to the outside. I'll tell you to this day, nobody has discovered these virtual valves or actual valves. We still don't know why the flow is always to the outside. We've got some fairly good ideas, but we don't know.
How does the fluid get back?
get to that. It's the blood. It's the blood. I mean, you're going to be infused, pardon the pun, with blood as a source of fluid by the end of this talk, I hope. Well, now we are settled on the idea that fluid is important in the process by which the environmental stresses are expressed by the growth and remodeling in bone. But where is all this fluid in the bone, to partially answer your question? Well, the major part of the fluid in the bone comes from blood flow. But blood flow is in vessels that go through the bone. Okay? And that mass of fluid doesn't all empty into the bone. So that's not what we're really talking about. We're talking about the flow of fluid in bone as it relates to the cells in the bone. So we have that source. We can think about it as a source of fluid. But it is passing through. It's a conduit. It gets into the bone by leaking out. Okay? Think of these vessels as being porous in their walls. And the fluid does leak out. The process is called in the global sense as extravasation, extra outside vessel vasation. And it's more known in physiology as capillary filtration, because the vessels that are leaking are the capillaries. And that's how the fluid gets into the bone, from the blood vessels by capillary filtration. Now what happens after the fluid gets out of the vessels? Well, it flows in the bone somehow. And we call this flow, since it's around the cells that are in the bone, outside the vessels, bone interstitial fluid flow, or BIF. Where does it flow? It flows in the very canal that the vessel is located, that around the vessel. Okay, the vessel is in a larger tube, and the fluid leaks out of the vessel, and of course the fluid's going to flow around the vessel first. It's also going to flow in very tiny canals that come off of that main canal. This is a Haversian canal, for those of you that remember your anatomy a little bit, that we're referring to here, Haversian and Volkmann canals. These are little canals, very narrow, but long. And these flow around, we're going to talk about osteocytes in just a minute, they flow around other cells, but they're branches that come out from the Haversian canals. And then finally, you get the most micro of microfluidic flow, that flow between the collagen molecules that are mineralized to give you the hard part of bone. So we're really at the micro level. We're talking about flow molecule to molecule. And here's a picture of what's happening. Okay, it's kind of a summary picture. This is a cortical bone. Now we've got a cross-section through the bone. So you cut the bone and look end on. Okay, and you see a lot of tiny holes. You know, in my students in class, I always give them a little magnifying glass, and sometimes they can make it out. I give them a piece of bone, and it's been cut this way, and they can kind of make out these little holes. These are Haversian canals, the famous Haversian canals. In these Haversian canals are located the vessels. Where do the vessels come from? Where is a big vessel that comes through the cortex, branches in the marrow, this is the marrow here, and the branches then branch again and give off these tinier branches that go into cortical bone. This is called the endosteum, and this is the periosteum. And the net flow, again, remember from Mikarski and Monroe, is from this end to this end. And we haven't found the valves yet. But inside these little Haversian canals, where you have the little capillaries, the capillaries with capillary filtration extravasate the fluid. And in this case, that movement of the fluid is shown by a molecule that's been injected somewhere upstream called ferritin. And the ferritin is leaking out. Now, as the fluid leaks out of the vessels, it'll drag solute with it. It's called solvent drag. And these ferritin molecules, they're enormous in size, about 500 kilodaltons, percolate through these layers, which we call lamellae, outward, there's higher pressure here, and finally come to the outermost portion of this structure, which we call an osteon, and then joins up with another percolating front from the adjacent osteon, and eventually you have this enormous front, moving again, endosteal to periosteal end, propagates up here, and then the fluid is picked up by the periosteal lymphatics and eventually returned to the bloodstream. So did this partially answer your question? So you have the complete circulation here, okay? And there's volume conservation. Okay, we don't lose anything here. Now, meanwhile, there are also very tiny canals. You can see down here they've been drawn. Barely see them. These are the canaliculi, leading off from the Haversian canals to to these little, they look like little caverns, little pockets. Inside these little pockets are associated the cell of most interest to people studying osteoporosis. These are called the osteocytes. These are the cells that exchange calcium with the bone matrix. They're located in these little pockets, and they all communicate with one another through these little canaliculi. It's a syncytium, all right? They're all related. It's almost like a big nerve network. And each one of these little holes contains a osteocyte. There's one cell in each one, and the cell, it looks like Hydra, has all these processes that stick out and go into these canaliculi. We'll be referring to them a little bit more.
How big are these holes, roughly?
They're about, that's about 20 microns. Okay. Yeah.
Do the osteocytes sort of live in their given hole, or do they
travel? They're trapped. They are trapped. That's the whole rest of their life is going to be spent in that little cell. I mean, it's they're monks. It's just like, this is a big monastery, a lot of monks. Okay? Okay? But these are unusual looking monks, you know, they look like Hydra. I think I'm stretching your imagination with that, you know, with the metaphor.
Just an obvious question, but you might get to it. There's a pressure gradient, but what about osmotic pressure gradient? Is there an osmosis?
There is an osmotic gradient. You have to look at the individual vessels. I don't have time to go into all of it. But there is an osmotic gradient within the vessels. The albumin is the primary source of the high osmotic pressure inside, and it tends to draw fluid into the vessel. But there is a hydrostatic pressure that comes from the heart, okay? And also, as I'm going to show later, it comes from muscle that's outside the bone.
Oh, so you're saying there's like gradients is in the opposite direction of the flow. It's not another ions creating the osmotic pressure.
No. At the beginning, if you talk about a vascular bed, okay, capillary bed, at the beginning of the bed, the hydrostatic pressure dominates because it's upstream, okay? By the time you get energy dissipation through that whole capillary bed, you've got much lower hydrostatic pressure, and you have the same osmotic pressure, but this time the osmotic pressure is higher than the hydrostatic pressure, so the tendency is for the fluid to come from the extravascular space into the vessel. Okay. However, recent research shows that that doesn't happen as much as we used to think. And the fluid that gets back to the bloodstream, after the fluid leaks out of the vessels by capillary filtration, it's got to get back to the blood somehow. It gets back more by the capillaries of the lymphatic system than it does from the what we call the venules, the venular capillaries.
Yeah, I guess I was also thinking about the donor potential. You see, yeah, lots of
oh, well, the proteins I was referring to were the proteins that are in the matrix outside, okay, but they have associated with them a lot of proteoglycans. And the proteoglycans do tend to bind a lot of water, okay? So they are not presenting as much of an osmotic gradient as you might think, because they're occupied. And, of course, there's some calcium.
Okay, I mean, there's water out. It's not about the flow now. There's an osmotic gradient out of the vessel. That would be a gradient for flow.
Yeah, but it's not as strong.
Okay.
Yeah, the osmotic gradient is constant, but it's dominated by the hydrostatic gradient, the pressure gradient from the inside of the vessel out. It's dominated at the beginning of the vascular bed, and it dominates at the end, but recent research suggests that it's not that great. Okay? So, and I used to always give this, when I talk about the circulatory system, I always used to make a big deal of reabsorption by the blood vessels. Now I got to back off because recent research said, well, it's not that great. The lymphatic system is very important. It's now more important than it used to be. Okay, we can go on. Here's an example of this capillary filtration, and I stress, this is not loaded bone. What you're looking at here is our bone chamber. We're looking into cortical bone. These are capillaries of cortical bone. And we've injected a dye. And the dye is fluorescent. And it's leaking out of the vessels. This is the normal diameter of this vessel. But the dye is leaking out so much that it creates a halo around the vessel and makes the vessel look a lot bigger. But this is extravascular dye that's out into the extravascular space. Now, because it's just a fluorescent picture, you can't see the bone that this is in, but this is in bone. And it's without loading. So you get capillary filtration, you don't need to load to get it. Well, there has been some recent evidence, well, 1990 is getting kind of old now, that the cell-stimulating fluid mechanical signal, we've been talking about the importance of fluids, but what actually is the fluid doing at the cell level? I mean, that question has to be ultimately answered if we're going to get a mechanism that Wolf brought us to the point of looking at. The cell-stimulating fluid mechanical signal is strain that's generated by fluid shear stress at the bone cell fluid interface. Now, this is in vitro. We just took a bunch of bone cells, put them in a dish, and let the fluid flow over them. And when the fluid flowed over them, they expressed prostaglandins, they expressed all kinds of indications that they were activated. So they obviously have receptors for this kind of signal. When the fluid stopped flowing, no expression, okay?
But doesn't it take a few days to get them back to where they used to be? I mean, this is a big problem with endothelial cell culture, that you put them from fluid flow to static, mm-hmm. And you get all these great signals, you know, and then you just put them back to where they used to be.
Well, these cells are just grown on the dish,
yeah.
Okay, and then you have no flow. They're just grown in a fluid that's static. Then you start the flow,
yeah.
Okay, you get activation, you stop the flow, and the activation stops. In fact, the endothelial cell is the foundation for the idea for these experiments.
Yeah, and so that whole area of research was kind of flawed in the sense that endothelial cells that came from, say, an umbilical cord were used to be in flow.
Mm-hmm.
You take them into culture.
Oh, I see what you mean.
You know, I won't say it's retarded, but it's...
Yeah, but these cells are not... The idea came from endothelial cells, and John Frangos, is the one you ought to discuss that with the most. He's going to be here.
I will do.
Yeah, because that's his area of expertise. Of course, I'm interested in the endothelial cells because I'm a circulation guy. But he'll talk about the mechanic part because he did the experiment. That's his group. This is one of his students.
Yeah,
he did the work. But in bone cells, they're not under shear all the time.
Okay?
So they live at some moments under shear and other moments not under shear.
A quick question about that.
Sure.
Is it specifically the shear stress, or is it exchange of the molecules sitting next to the cells that could be doing this?
This group recently did an experiment in which they reduced the ionic strength of the overlying fluid, and they got the response was almost the same. They were really challenging the people who have proposed a stream potential model, okay, which I haven't gotten into yet, okay, and that's still in competition with the shear stress model. And they seem to indicate from their data, this is Frangos' group again, that it is the pure shear. And all that requires is that at the surface of the cell, you have mechanotransducers, okay? And I'm gonna show you a picture which I hope to indicate how these mechanotransducers might work.
But if the cell exudes stuff which the fluid flow is carrying off,
mm-hmm.
then it could be something like that.
Could.
That would be proportional to the shear stress because it's proportional to the flow.
Okay, so you're in a sense you're talking about a concentration gradient.
Yes.
Okay, but the concentration gradient can be confused with a zeta potential, which is also a kind of concentration gradient of ions. And that's where the stream potential comes in. How you totally eliminate that is kind of difficult because you can't put a cell in pure distilled water, it'll be destroyed. You know, I can't take that kind of environment. What you have to do is try to tweak the system and get close. The cell's still alive. And if you don't show a reduction in the response as you reduce the ionic strength, then you can conclude that it's not responding to ionic strength. Question?
Sorry, two quick things. First, what's the typical flow velocity in the canaliculate?
Oh. I hate to tell you how many times Shelley Weinbaum has asked me that question. Nobody's measured that. That's very difficult.
You can't false label it and...
They have no way of visualizing it.
And they're too small for them.
Yeah. I mean, my system can visualize the capillaries. Okay? We're talking about a living system. It has to be a living system. My system can visualize the capillaries, but I can't get to the magnifications required to visualize flow in a canaliculus. I mean, canaliculus is, we're talking about maybe 5 microns at the most across.
But if it's going to give you a
Yeah, yeah, but it's, there's all, there's the wall effect. There's always the wall effect, okay? So you're going to have a shear that's colored by the fact that you've got a bounded system, okay? You've got a no-slip region, it's very low Reynolds number, extremely low Reynolds number, and you're talking about a system that's operating so close to where the molecules begin to dominate, where molecular forces begin to dominate.
You can't do any of your stuff to calculate.
It's not an easy problem.
Okay, I have one other question, which I don't think you're going to address it, but just very quickly. I know that it's a normal bone development. If you don't have vascularization, you don't get normal vertebral bone formation. When does vascularization start during normal bone development? And what happens if you don't have vascularization to bone development?
If you're talking about embryologically,
yes.
Okay. Embryologically, what you have is what's called an onlog, and it is primarily cartilage in nature. Okay, and it becomes mineralized. And the mineralization is accompanied very quickly thereafter by an influx of endothelial cells. At this stage, it may be angiocytes. This may be true embryonic endothelial cells, which are extremely rare in an adult. So in the formation of the embryo, it's very closely associated. But you have a structure first, okay? And then you get this invasion. It's actually suggestive of what's called endochondral ossification in the healing of a fracture. So it's kind of a repeat of that. Here is the osteocyte in its lacuna, okay? So the hydra I was talking about, this cell that's trapped in those little pockets that we saw, and each one of these, this is a canaliculus. Each, and this is a process. Here, the hydra's hairs are the processes, and the little canals that they're in are the canalicula. Here is the microporous flow in the matrix. Here's the macroporous flow, which is around the periosteocyte. Peri just means around. The flow around the osteocyte, okay? And here's the actual picture of an osteocyte. That's not a nucleus. Somebody just stamped an O in there. That just means osteocyte. And then, of course, this is all in that matrix that we saw. And here's a picture that I was referring to. If you imagine that this is the osteocyte, and here's the model that sort of relates to what Frangos and others have been talking about. A typical cell it's covered with a glycocalyx, all right? Now, you talked about the shear influencing these molecules, also influencing the exchange of molecules across the surface. All of that can go on. But the original argument between the two models, stream potential versus shear stress, was that you've got a charged fluid flowing over these cells, and you've got a fixed charge. Of course, this could be the matrix of the bone. And the charges in the fluid relative to the charged still unmoving surface establishes a streaming potential, and the surface has the zeta potential that you need to get the streaming potential. This cell is covered with this glycocalyx, and each of these molecules sticks out. If you shear this enough, you bend the molecules. You could have a piezoelectric effect within these molecules, but it's considered a mechanical signal because you're talking about what the nature of the signal that you're imposing is, okay? When you're talking about what's more important, streaming potential or shear stress. So in this case, the choice for shear stress, even though you may actually produce by bending these surface molecules a piezoelectric effect, that's local. That's local. That may be part of the overall mechanism, but it's not their induced mechanism. Okay, and this could be not just an osteocyte. There's evidence now for osteoblasts. Osteoclasts, a little more trouble because it's hard to culture osteoclasts. Okay, so to do the in vitro test first, you know, is a little more difficult with osteoclasts. But if we show that all three cells are really receptive to shear stress, then we have a whole new idea for how modulation on both ends, resorption and osteogenesis, is controlled by environmental stress, by mechanical stress. So the Tokarski and Monroe, again, we start off with them to get the historical perspective. By looking at bone and the bending of bone and the movement of fluid, they also came to this secondary conclusion that bone is like a big sponge. It's not like a rock, the old concept that you see in museums of this solid, stiff material. It's more like a sponge. It's fluid-filled. And of course, when you bend the sponge, the fluid starts sloshing around in it. Now, Frangos, who had worked with endothelial cells, came to the notion, actually, I know him, and I know he didn't quite do it this way, but it sounds more colorful when he does it this, when I explain it this way. Since endothelial cells and osteoblasts come from the same mesenchymal stem cell, they must have an evolutionary link, a kind of a conservation of mechanism. And the osteoblast and the osteocyte probably operate and respond to environmental signals in similar ways, because they have similar heritage. And so in any case, he decided to try some of the experiments that he'd been doing on endothelial cells on bone cells, and lo and behold, he came up with this idea of fluid shear stress from in vitro. He's worked in vitro only. So, I mean, maybe some of you who are integrated physiology people would say, oh, but he only worked in vitro. You know, how could that apply to the whole organism? Well, you can also argue that this guy is way to the other, in the other direction. What he did, he took the results of Frangos and he integrated them to the entire cortical bone and made a model. And he said that bone is not merely a sponge. It's a poroelastic matrix. And of course that gets the engineers all excited, you know, because this is a word that has implication, because there are all kinds of physical models for poroelastic matrix. Biot is the probably the big name. It's the one I heard the most, at least. And he took the model of biot for poroelastic deformation and he applied it to the cortical bone and used Frangos' ideas and came up with his model in 1994, in which he showed the shear stress of bone fluid flowing over osteocytes causes surface strains which activate them. And he calculated the flow of the fluid that must exist, and he took data out of the literature, and he seemed to have a working model. Okay, he seemed to have a model that really predicted that there's enough shear stress on the cells in the bone to cause remodeling. Meanwhile, and I always have to give equal time to the streaming potential idea, because it may still function. It may be minor, but it may still be there, and I don't think it should be just thrown out. Pollock is one of the advocates of that. He was testing for streaming potentials. And he'd been doing it. He was still publishing it at 2001, but he's kind of retired now. There's not many people that are taking up the flag. So by assuming that bone is a poroelastic solid which repels the fluid phase when deformed, Weinbaum developed a model which predicts BIF shear values that are sufficient for cell-stimulating strains. The data he got were from Frangos' experiment. And this is under normal bending loads. However, there's a little fly in the ointment. Some recent analysis, well, 2001, by Buechner and others, showed that as you increase the frequency of the bending of bone, as you walk faster or as you run, as you do exercise, there's a damping effect. So in fact, what should be more stimulatory to the bone cells, and we all know that if you exercise, you increase your bone mass. Well, that wasn't happening. That shouldn't happen. So we've got a flaw in the Weinbaum model. There's another flaw. The data that Weinbaum was using was not correctly used, okay? And he discovered that when he recalculated, he could only get half, at most, half the required shear stress for stimulating the bone cells. So they've gone back to the drawing board. And we started to think about this problem ourselves. The insufficiency of the poroelastic model, plus some evidence that there was involvement of the blood vessel, led us to try to propose a model that was based upon what the blood vessels were contributing to BIF. And some of the evidence was that if you ligate the exit vessels from a bone, you enhance healing of a fracture. Now, this is not an experiment that you're going to get past the IRB at a hospital. You know, on human patients, this is not something that you're going to get orthopedic surgeons anxious to perform. So this was performed on dogs. Okay, and how does this happen? When you ligate the exit vessel, you build up the pressure in the capillary bed, you drive the fluid out, you increase capillary filtration. Now, where is the normal force for driving fluid out of the capillary coming from? It's sort of not coming from ligation. You don't normally put a tourniquet on your leg whenever you have a fracture. Do we have a question?
When you're finished with this slide, yes.
Okay. Okay, well, what we look for a source of pressure other than heart, okay, that would really add something to the hydrostatic pressure in the vessels. And we discovered, particularly where limbs are concerned, that there is, it's the skeletal muscle outside the bone that can generate a lot of pressure. But now how does the pressure generated by a contracting muscle outside a bone translate to an increase in hydrostatic pressure in a capillary deep inside a bone? Okay? That gives me the next slide, now I can answer your question, or I'll try.
At the beginning, you put down a theorem, so to speak, that said that tension-induced osteogenesis and compression-induced resorption. Is that out the window now, or is that still something you believe in? And if it is something you believe in, how does the shear flow distinguish between compressional and tensional forces on the bulk bone?
Okay. First of all, that's a clinical observation. Okay, so it can't be out the window. That's a clinical observation. Okay, and I did not have time to present the data, but what happens is that when you compress the side of the bone that's compressed, if a bone bends, it's the easiest way to look at it. The side that's compressed, the vessels in it reduce flow. Okay, you see a drop in flow of those vessels. On the tension side, you see increased flow. Okay, and you can go down that line and start, you can postulate an awful lot from that simple observation. Now, here's the context. Here's how we relate the bone, the skeletal muscle around the bone, to the capillaries within the bone. Here's a typical bone, it's a femur. There's the cortical bone, and it's surrounded with muscle. And the muscle is in its compartment. Each of the components, the quadriceps muscle is actually it's four muscles in a package here. Each one has its own surrounding fascia. Now, fascia is a tissue that's very flexible, but it's very inextensible. It's not very extensible at all. You can't stretch it. You can bend it all over the place. And it surrounds this compartment, and the vessels that are located going through the muscle, okay, are located there. There are also vessels located in adjacent compartments, but these compartments are also lined. Okay, so the whole thing is encased in a big compartment, and you have some minor compartments. Okay, and you can see that when the muscle contracts, a vessel that happens to be anywhere near that's parallel with that, that's going by that contracting muscle, is going to get squeezed. And the blood within it is going to want to move away from the squeeze point. Well, if it's the part of that vessel that's toward the heart, will allow the fluid to go up toward the heart. But the part that's away from the heart, that's further away from the heart, that's below the squeeze point, cannot flow out of the squeeze because it's valved. Okay? It's prevented from doing so. In fact, this is how you get blood back to your heart. If you're in an upright position for too long, this is what prevents blood pooling in your lower extremities, because if that were allowed to happen, the blood would never make it to the head, and you have a wonderful hemostatic mechanism that allows that to correct itself. It's called syncope, or fainting. That puts you in a horizontal position, so gravity is no longer creating the problem. But it can be painful, depending on how you fall. So how does this muscle pump generate a BIF driving pressure in the bone? First of all, you remember that when the muscle contracts, the bone's going to bend. the fluid saturated bone, when it is bent, is going to cause the fluid, like in a sponge, to shift. That's the poroelastic model. But also, the arteries and veins next to the bone are compressed by muscle contractions. Some of these pressures can get awfully high. Now, this is not a reasonable figure. I went through the literature seeing the highest pressure generated by a skeletal muscle contraction. And this was in some poor rat that was exercised on a treadmill practically to death. I just wanted a high number to show that it's possible to get these kinds of pressures. Also, you have to remember that if we're going to introduce exercise into the picture, that the exercise makes the heart go faster and your baseline pressure in the blood goes up. Okay, of course, this is not in the capillaries, but still the baseline pressure is going to go up everywhere. 180 millimeters of mercury is not unreasonable. And here's the model. Muscle contracts. Okay, this is a cortex of bone. This is marrow. All right, and here is a muscle outside the bone connected by tendons. And here's a vein that's going by the muscle in an adjacent compartment or same compartment. Here's an artery. When the muscle contracts, it shortens and it fattens. It gets thick in the center, compresses against the vessel, and that contraction sets up a pressure wave in the vessel. A solitary pressure wave is the simplest way to look at it. And a solitary pressure wave is a soliton. Okay, those of you in engineering know this very well. This soliton goes propagating upstream in the vein and comes up against the valve and wham, shuts the valve. So you get stagnant fluid here. In the artery, it's the other way around. It's going downstream, propagates all the way down the artery into the capillaries of the cortical bone and increases the pressure in the capillaries and drives capillary filtration. Now I'm showing reabsorption here, which does occur to some extent. And that's essentially the model. Very simple. Contraction sets that up. This I added on simply because some people, particularly the Weinbaum group, has been interested in trying to show that the pressure in the marrow is contributing to the cortical bone. And I had to show that there's also another path. Those vessels that don't branch into the cortical bone, they branch into the middle of the marrow, into sinusoids, and the fluid in the sinusoids comes out very easily. These are very porous vessels. They're like bulbous things, and this is where the new cells that are made by the stem cells, the new blood cells, are put. Okay, and pressure builds up within the marrow that way. Okay, is there evidence that the muscle pump enhances capillary filtration in cortical bone? We've been talking about the model. Is there any evidence to support it? Well, our preliminary data suggested the muscle pump generated pressure waves in vessels are propagated in bone capillaries. And we use intervital microscopy, and we've been able to see that they alter vascular pressure. We deduce that from seeing microsphere motion, and also they drive convective transport across the vessel wall, and we see that from dye leakage. But is this driving of this fluid out of the vessel fast enough so that we get cell-stimulating BIF? We don't know the answer to that. Okay, I'm going to show you now evidence of the changing of pressure, contraction of the muscle. What you're going to see here are two sequences. In the first sequence, you see the normal movement of blood in capillaries inside cortical bone, and you'll see the microspheres moving. And in the second sequence, you'll see the very jerky motion created by the contraction of the skeletal muscle outside the bone. Now we have released this muscle. The muscle has been cut from the bone so that it's not bending the bone. So the only influence that this muscle can bring upon the capillaries within the cortical bone has to be by squeezing the vessels that are going through the muscle. All right, now let's see if this works. It's on the card. I think I've got this off the card. It says
running it directly off the card.
I'm running it off the card.
Oh.
And but I'm not known.
Okay.
They would just pay it externally.
Yeah, you can pay it externally. Do you wanna do, try that?
It's going to be, ADI.
This corner?
Yeah, that's it.
That's it?
Oh, good.
You got it, you got it.
Here you go. And this is the, look at the vessels over here first. You can see the microspheres. Okay.
Where are those buttons on there, must be.
Click on the top next to the X.
Yeah. Let's try it again with the full screen.
Yeah, it's just, I need to see it full screen. The microspheres are. Yeah, but the center part is still kind of small.
Yeah, I think that's right. Here's a zoom. If you go to view.
Okay, go to view. And the thing is, okay, here are the microspheres. Now, the memory makes this kind of jerky, and it should be smooth. Now, here's contraction, and it's even more jerky. It's hard to know because you need, there's much, these particles are moving through in an extremely jerky fashion. There's a superimposed jerkiness from the slowness of the video memory here.
How big are the microspheres?
The microspheres are 1 micron. Okay, and the vessels are approximately, they range from 10 up to 20 microns in that particular sequence. Well, let's see. I'm not sure.
This button on the left.
At the very bottom.
Oh, at the very bottom.
Yeah, the arrow.
Bottom
and
the
right arrow over on the left.
Oh.
Bottom left of your screen.
Bottom left of the screen.
The big arrow.
Ah,
there you go.
If I can, okay, let's see.
Click that, maybe click it again. Click that arrow.
This arrow keeps wanting to move. Keeps wanting.
Click that, there you go.
Well, let's see if I'm. The arrow jumps every time I move.
Okay.
Now, why is that jumping? It's as if I've got some kind of. There. All right, there. Okay, here you see, but it's still not as smooth as it would be with a lot of memory, and maybe it shows up.
Is that more or less real time?
Well, as much as it can be with this jerky motion, it's been slowed down because it's not running smoothly. It's slower than real time because of the memory, of the video memory here.
What's the size of the image? How far is it?
It's 1 millimeter, it's 2 millimeters across.
2 millimeters.
The circle is 2 millimeters across. Okay, well, I'm running over time here. I need to move on to. I'm having trouble clicking the right button. That's my problem.
Go back to your mouse.
Yeah, where do you click the?
Just like down there.
Yeah, where's the? How do I get back to the? The presentation. Let's go right to that one here. Yeah, there are only a few slides left, so let's. Whoops. Okay, that's one way to do it. Okay, just the last few slides. Okay, here is the. Okay. After 60 minutes of this, okay, and this, now we're not talking about a muscle. In the previous picture, the muscle was released. This is data from Terry Hawkins Pinnell, my graduate student, just got her PhD. This is from her PhD thesis, in which she showed after 60 minutes, and this is with the muscle attached, you get an increase, a lag increase in blood flow in the vessels when you contract the muscle. And I didn't stress the data for the muscle, the contraction. It's transcutaneous electrical nerve stimulation. And here is the effect on capillary filtration. In the muscle pump, presence of the muscle pump, this is the increase in capillary filtration, and here it was in the control. And these are statistically significantly different. And for those interested in bone, over a period of 8 weeks of this treatment, 6 days a week, you get an increase in bone formation.
Why does it increase in the control?
Oh, that's just talking about the amount of dye that's outside the vessel.
Okay.
Obviously, it's going to keep increasing,
wow,
you know, over time. Okay, this is, you know, natural, because it can't be emptied out that fast. The capillaries of the lymphatics aren't that fast. So we've got to, in the future, okay, we've shown that there is some evidence for the muscle pump influencing capillary filtration. And in the future, there are some things that we have to do. We really have to know how fast that fluid is exiting the capillaries before we can say that it's creating the kind of shear stress we need. And we have to look at the effect of just the muscle alone. This is kind of a terminal experiment, because you can't just cut off, every time you observe the rabbit, you can't just cut the muscle and then reattach it at the end of the observation. This will never pass the animal committee. And then you have to do the above at very high levels of exercise to show the influence of exercise. So we're going to have to do all this like on a treadmill. That's going to be easy. And then, of course, we'd like to, being in bioengineering, we'd like to try this when we add a scaffold to the bone and see if that influences the incorporation of the scaffold. I seem to be actually within the time limit. I was afraid it was going to go over. But I have about 5 minutes left. I just had to show you the acknowledgments. If you're really interested in acknowledgments, it's on the handout.